Welcome to the Unconventional Path, Entrepreneurship and Innovation Stories and Ideas. I'm Bela Musitz. Today we are doing something a little bit different. As our longtime listeners know, Mike and I like to change things up once in a while. Today, Mike and I interview Chris Kubisak. Chris is an organizational psychologist and an avid sailor. We interviewed him for the other podcast that Mike and I also do, which is all about sailing. That podcast is called Sailing the East. You should check it out if you have any interest in sailing or sort of some of the other adventures that I and Mike get into. In this episode, we discussed how psychology and human behavior play a large role in sailing. Many of the aspects of our conversation also apply to business and leadership. So we decided to rebroadcast the podcast on this The Unconventional Path podcast. We hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did.
Hello, and welcome to the Sailing and Cruising the East Coast of the United States podcast. I'm Bela Musitz.
And I'm Mike Wasserman.
This is our podcast about sailing the East Coast of the United States. In some episodes, we focus on passages and destinations. In other episodes, we talk about boats, equipment, and techniques. And when we come across an interesting person, we'll try to get them as a guest on the show. Before we dive into this episode, we need to say a special thank you to our supporters. Several listeners are supporting the podcast via Patreon. If you would like to join them, you can do so by going to patreon.com/sailingtheeast.
Hey, Bela, great to see you. And yes, indeed, thanks to our listeners for their support. Bela, we have something a little bit different today. It's going to be a joint interview with, as longtime listeners will know, our repeat guest, Chris Kubisak, who joined us in episode 101. Chris, hi, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Chris, thanks for joining us. First time you and I have met, but although I've seen you on video when I did the editing of episode 101, Mike and I thought, given your background in sailing and your training as a psychologist, Mike and I thought it would be good to have a conversation with you about sort of the psychology of sailing.
Sure.
Kind of from racing and cruising, and also sort of about how supportive the kind of cruising and sailing community is. You know, these three aspects of sailing, at least that I've encountered, are very different. And some individuals participate in all three of them and others just in one. So I thought maybe first, let's talk a little bit about racing. So, you know, you work as a psychologist and you yourself have done some leadership coaching. You've worked with organizations to figure out how to make them more effective and efficient. And you've raced a lot. You've done a lot of sailboat racing. So how can things from the racing environment carry over to the workplace? In terms of being an effective teammate and an effective leader?
Well, it's an excellent question. The primary thing I would say is communication, which big shock, right? But communication is absolutely critical. There is an old cliche in sailboat racing that the most effective crews are very, very quiet. And they are, like, when you see a really polished crew do a mark rounding, almost nothing is said. But that doesn't mean there isn't communication going on. It's because they've practiced, because they know what they're doing, because they all have tremendous situational awareness about what everyone else in the crew is doing, what the boat is doing, and how it relates to what's going on around there. But to get to that point, you have to have a lot of shared experiences. You have to have a lot of shared understanding about what the goals are, what the mission is, and how you get there. And some of that is dependent upon effective leadership. That is, you have to have someone who is organizing the whole crew, organizing the race effort, and being sort of a centralized decision-making tree. But there's also an element of democracy that comes into play there. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to one of the other questions. But there's a key, you know, understanding of what has to happen on the boat and what your role in that is. And the only way to get to that point is, one, to communicate effectively, two, to understand, you know, what are the other people doing and how do I tie into that? And it's incumbent upon the skipper, too, to put together an effective crew. There is an element of identification of strengths and weaknesses, most skippers, you know, to go into kind of the workplace psychology of it, most skippers would love to have a selection model where they can, you know, say, we're going to get a guy for the bow, and we're going to get a guy to do pit, and we're going to get somebody to do sail trim. And it never works that way, right? I mean, realistically, you get the crew that you get, especially in, you know, like perf handicap racing on the west coast of Florida, for example. And it's a classification model, really. It's how do I optimize the crew that I have, the experience that they bring, the coordination with each other, and then put them in a place to succeed to optimize the performance of the boat, much like you would develop a team in a workplace and putting people together based on those strengths and experiences and skills and abilities. And then how do they handle a crisis? You know, there's also that element of, do they have the experience individually, and do they have the experience together to, when something, you know, unexpected happens, are they able to respond to that in an effective way? Are they going to communicate with each other effectively? You know, very often you'll have a new person in the crew, and, you know, how do they respond? Sometimes you get the guy that thinks he's a rock star and knows everything better than anybody else on the boat. Other times, and what you really want in crew is somebody who's willing to ask questions, you know, admit that they don't know something and be willing to ask those questions, and hopefully have somebody on the crew who's willing to walk them through what to do. That's important. And then the other element that I would emphasize, well, there's two really. One is if you have a good skipper, or sometimes it's not necessarily the guy driving the boat, but the tactician, somebody who is really good interpersonally and can read the crew and read the boat. One of the best skippers I know, he's a phenomenal sailor, but his real skills come through in managing crew for different events. Like, the way that you deal with people and interact with people is different on a Thursday night beer can race than it is, you know, if you're racing IC37s at the New York Yacht Club. And he is masterful at adjusting his approach interpersonally and technically from the sailing side to address those different angles. And I think that, again, translates into the workplace, in that you have to know your situation. You have to know when to lean on the gas, and you have to know when to back off and let people do things. And you got to have a pretty good understanding of when you need to take charge and say, guys, it's going to be this, versus having more of a democratic approach and saying, all right, collectively, how do we want to decide on how to proceed with something? And then the last thing would be feedback. And this is probably the single most overlooked thing by sailing crews. You know, we all know from workplace research, the, you know, proximal feedback is best. When an incident takes place, you know, you provide feedback, you know, what happened, what was your understanding, you know, what could we have done differently? You really can't do that in a yacht race. I mean, things happen quickly, and there isn't time in the, you know, you're getting ready for the next mark rounding or for the next tack or what have you. So there isn't time to deconstruct that. So you do it typically at the end of the race. But, you know, the post-race debrief with a beer in your hand is not nearly as effective as some of the sailing publications would have you believe. So, you know, if you're really serious about it, you can do that and insist that everybody attend and be attentive. What I find to be a little bit more effective is a post-race email. Some of the best skippers that I've raced, you know, a day or two after the race, they'll reflect on what went well, what didn't go well, you know, highlight a few good things that people did. Just to provide some positive reinforcement, and then put that in an email and send it out to the crew so that everybody has kind of an assessment of what happened. And then there's some back and forth about that. You know, why did this happen, or what could we have done differently? That can be pretty effective as well. But again, you know, it's some of the lessons learned from sailing do translate into the workplace, in that, you know, best practices are best practices, but everything is contingent on the environment that you're in. And in a sailboat race, it's kind of a unique environment.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, really interesting, Chris. Let's change gears a little bit and talk about cruising. Sure. And, you know, one thing is the outsider that strikes me is you're out on the water by yourself, right? You and your crew, and that's it, and lots of water. It's not like driving a car or even, you know, going hiking where, you know, there's people around and there's help you can get. You're totally responsible for your safety and your survival of yourself and the people on your boat. And I know that as an organizational psychologist, you have helped your clients develop responsiveness and resilience and the whole concept of change management so that they can improve their outcomes, such as employee satisfaction or retention or customer satisfaction. What types of organizational and planning skills do sailors develop that they can carry over into the workplace to improve the performance of individual people or teams or whole organizations?
Sure. In cruising, it's a very different animal. As you noted, planning and prioritization are critical, like 100% critical. And I can't emphasize that enough. And it can be a bit of drudgery. Like, you know, the initial planning is great. Oh, we're going to go to this island and that island. And, you know, you lay it all out and it's all wonderful. And then you get into the mechanics of, well, what do we need? How do we need to provision the boat? What needs to be repaired on the boat? What kind of maintenance issues are there? And it's not the most exciting or romantic thing, but, you know, you got to do it. You know, from a personal perspective, like I don't like to pack. I love to travel. I don't like to pack for trips. I find it kind of annoying. But the most stressful packing I've ever done is if I'm cruising for a week or worse yet, racing on a race that's going to be 3 or 4 days on the water, because you really have to plan ahead for every contingency. You know, when you go on a business trip, if you forget your contact lens solution, you go to the store. It's fine. Get a new toothbrush, whatever you need. When you're at sea for 4 days, there is no recourse. Like if you didn't plan it and anticipate it and have a contingency in place for it, you're lost. You know, you gotta figure out a different way around. So that's challenging. It gets better with time. In my case, I have lists of things that I've prepared from experience, from talking to other people, from experienced sailors who know what they're doing. So I have a little bit of a leg up. In that sense, you know, that kind of translates to the workplace in terms of having a mentor, having someone who has done it before, who is coming with you, who can, you know, give you insight into the things you don't know you don't know. So that's critical. We also go back to communication again. When you prepare your crew, you want to make sure that everybody is on the same page about what to expect. If we're on a cruise, you know, what is the nature of the cruise? Are we island hopping and going from a mooring ball to a mooring ball to an anchorage to a marina to another mooring ball? That's a different type of sailing than, yeah, we're going to do a passage where we're going to be offshore overnight for 3 nights. Completely different environment, completely different preparation. And the crew needs to understand that. They need to understand that before they sign on to the trip. You know, some people go on a cruise and they're picturing, you know, is the blender going to be running and how many margaritas can I have per day? You don't do that when you're sailing offshore, especially in unpredictable weather. So alignment of the goals, you know, we talk about mission statements and visioning and all of that. It's not quite at that level, but there does have to be that alignment of goals and consistency in terms of my expectations as the skipper, your expectations as the crew, and also the shore, folks ashore. I can tell you many stories where, you know, we've been doing a cruise and something happens and some of us are significant others, you know, they're fine. They know what's going on. They've sailed. And other people are panic stricken. You know, I haven't heard from them in 3 days. I don't know what's going on. Well, what's going on is there's no wind and you're not going to hear from them for another day, but it's fine, you know? And so there's a lot involved in that type of preparation. And also plan for conflict resolution. You know, there will be things that happen that go sideways and, you know, you can't get more than 45 feet from each other. So you're going to have to deal with the people in the crew and understand that you're going to be upset. We'll get over it. You know, let's put a plan in place. Maybe we have a plan that if things get heated, somebody says, you know, a magic word and we cool off for 5 minutes or something like that, that everybody agrees to up front. So before it escalates, you can kind of, you know, through successful planning and anticipation, diffuse a situation before it gets bad. The other thing with cruising is adaptability. You know, you have to in sailing be adaptable. It's almost axiomatic. It's baked into the sport. But things will change. You know, the weather is not going to be what you thought it was going to be. Somebody gets seasick. You know, now you're down a person for a period of time. Something breaks. You know, and so when that happens, how do you make decisions? Ultimately, there is typically a captain or a boat owner aboard, and ultimately that is the centralization of the decision-making process and the leadership. But most crews tend to be more democratic, right? Like we're supposed to have fun. This is supposed to be enjoyable. Everybody has a say in what we do. So you try to operate as a little bit of a democracy, but at the end of the day, there has to be one person to make the decision. It sounds kind of silly, but this is one thing where the traditional pirates actually were extremely democratic, it turns out, in terms of there was a captain, but most of the high level decision making was made democratically by the crew. And, you know, they were mercenaries. Everybody had a share. They had, you know, captain got more, first mate got a little bit less than that. Each crew member gets a share, what have you. But they all had a vested interest in the success of that crew and the success of that ship. And because of that, they would make decisions actually very democratically. So it's not all Captain Bly, you know, screaming from the poop deck on what's going to go. It actually is involves a tremendous amount of communication and coordination among a lot of people, which is no small thing in a survival environment. And that kind of brings me to my last point, which is crisis management. You know, when something happens on a cruise, and it will happen, you know, keeping your wits about you and knowing that it's going to be okay. You know, it's typically, you know, people aren't lost at sea because they know they've planned ahead. They have confidence in themselves. They have confidence in each other. And so they're able to, you know, address any kind of situation that comes their way and deal with it. But it's something to consider in putting a crew together, you know, and it's a similar kind of thing. If you're making personal decisions in the workplace, you know, when you put a team together, look at the experience they have, you know, dealing with crisis management or dealing with each other. You know, you may have a team in your office that's been together. Maybe it's a little stale. Maybe they're becoming a little complacent. But man, if they've been through some fires together and they know, you know, that they can lean on each other and who's going to step up to what particular role to fix things, that's a good crew. That's a good team. That's what you want to see in those environments. And I guess one other point would be, you know, self-awareness. You know, be realistic about what you can do. I mean, we talk about setting realistic and attainable goals. Same thing in cruising. You know, be realistic about, if you're new to cruising, it's probably not a good idea to set off from, you know, the west coast of South America and head for Fiji. You know, maybe do a charter in the BVI. I mean, it's almost idiot proof. Anybody can do it. And you're going to learn a lot of things about yourself. You're going to learn about a lot of things about boats and weather. And you're going to learn a lot of things about crew that you didn't know before. And again, you don't know what you don't know. So take it in steps, take it in realistic, attainable goals as you go, and build up to what you ultimately want to do in terms of a challenge. You know, embrace the learning curve, as it were.
So Chris, I wanted to ask you a question. As you were talking about sort of racing and cruising,
sure.
And sort of they have common elements, but they also have some elements that are different. And I wanted to sort of think about a little bit about organizations and sort of the workplace. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that always struck me about most workplaces, if you think about racing, or you think about any sports, or you think about even like being in a band, you're going to practice, right? The team's going to get together, and you're going to practice, and during that practice, you're going to bond, you're going to learn about each other. And it's like you were saying, going around the mark, no one needs to say anything because everyone knows what they're doing and they can read the visual cues. So, right. You know, the band knows what the guitarist knows when to come in just because the drummer nodded his head. So, but we don't do any of that. We rarely do that sort of in business. Business is more like the cruising model. Right. Yeah. We sort of have a plan. We sort of talk about things, and there's some people maybe with experience, some people without experience, but we don't really sort of, except for maybe a fire drill in the building, we don't practice things. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's an interesting observation. You know, part of it is the constraint of the environment that you're in, like in sailing, like let's use racing as an example, right? You know, we talk a lot, and I mentioned this, we talk a lot about situational awareness. So, you know, I have to know what I'm doing. I have to know how it coordinates with the other people in the crew are doing. And we distinguish between, you know, situational awareness inside the lifelines, which is the crew and coordination, and outside the lifelines, which is what are the other boats doing? What are the tides doing? What is the wind doing? And, you know, as a crew member, I'm responsible for inside the lifelines, my role and what's going on. The skipper and the tactician are more outside the lifelines and figuring out at that level. So in an organization, you have a parallel of, we have our team or our business unit, and you know, I'm part of that and I understand what we're doing. And my manager should theoretically be looking outside the team and, you know, coordinating our efforts and utilizing our resources to accomplish goals that serve what's going on outside our team and the organization or the enterprise at large. Where it gets a little squirrely is, you know, you don't have as sharp a distinction in the workplace. You know, people come and go, they freelance, the individuals have their own aspirations, and, you know, they have communications with other parts of the organization. Maybe they're gunning for a job in another part of the you know, in another team or another functional area. And so you don't have that cut and dried element, and you don't really have practice. Like, nobody's going to get together at the office on a Saturday afternoon and practice work, right? Like, we'll get together and practice racing, but we're not going to practice working. So it's kind of, you know, learn it as you go, and the contingencies are a little bit different. And there's also the escape element. Like, in cruising, you know, you're committed to that boat for a period of time, whereas in the workplace, people kind of come and go. And there's a question of how invested are they really in that same mission and those same goals for that unit or for the enterprise at large. And I think that creates different prioritizations and different decision points for people. And those differences, I think, are pretty important. And it's an interesting observation that you make, because you can kind of shine a lens of you know, what's really going on and what are the team dynamics from that perspective, and look at it a little bit differently in terms of an open system versus a closed system. So I don't think I've really answered your question as much as fleshed it out more. So maybe perhaps this is a deeper dive podcast down the road.
Yeah, no, that was good. I that was helpful. Did you have anything to follow up with on this topic, Mike?
No, but I mean, I think there are some professions that do practice more than others, right? You mentioned, yeah, like, I know firefighters do a lot of training monthly. Right. Or I think about people in hospitals, right? They'll do like mass disaster preparedness training,
sure,
right?
I think absolutely.
That's pretty common. And that would be really interesting it'd be an interesting study to see if this sailing model, right, is effective for some of these jobs where they don't practice so much. And if you could show that there's monetary value in terms of lower costs, higher customer satisfaction, higher employee satisfaction, when you do this, you know, training gets kind of a bad rap in some parts of the business world, right? That it's not useful. And I wonder if this model might be a really interesting kind of literally a quantitative study.
I think it would.
Value.
Yeah. I think it would. I mean, and if it's not necessarily static training or not, I'm going to come in and do the thing that I do, and you're going to do the thing that you're going to do, and we're just going to do it, you know, repeatedly. I think where there might be some legs to this is cross training. And this is something that we do in sailing. So, you know, if you're on the bow, you need a good pit person. And a good pit person is essential to any crew. But for a person to be a good pit person, they really need to know what the bow person is doing. And so, you know, the best coordination happens when you can substitute the bow and the pit for each role, because they have to be coordinated. So maybe in a workplace setting, in the practice environment, you have somebody do a job that they're not normally doing, but that they have to coordinate with and get that sense of perspective of, oh, this is what it looks like from the other side. Now I know more. Now I have a little broader perspective on what's supposed to happen with other portions of the team, and I'm not seeing the same things that they normally see. And I think you could sell that to a work group more effectively. You know, I'm not going to come in on a Saturday and do the same thing I was doing, but if you either gamify it or add a novel element to it where I can see where I'm going to learn and I'm going to develop and I'm going to be better coming in on Monday than I was, then you can get them to do that.
Yeah. And I know a bunch of companies that do IT security training using gamification, right? Like with the escape room methodology, right, and things like, yep, this. So there's probably more of this that's out there, but I wonder, maybe there's an academic paper to be written about this, because even thinking about like hacking incidents, right? Okay, you've been hacked, or you're a marketing team, you just got really bad social media, right? Or, you know, doing these situational trainings like you do when you're out on a boat might be a really, you know, a really cool way to frame this. I don't know. You're right. That's a topic for another podcast.
Another conversation. Right? Yeah. But I think there's something there.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, bear in mind, like, the dream of every IO psychologist that I know that sails is, one day I'm going to buy a 50-foot boat. I'm going to do weekend or week-long charters and do team building exercises. And I know so many people that have thought through this and know it's going to be amazing. And it doesn't ever really work the way they want it to. And
there are a couple
reasons for that. Yeah. And it just, it doesn't click that way. There are elements that work, but it doesn't work quite the way that they want it to. And again, another conversation.
Yeah,
for sure.
So I'm going to change topics again on you, Chris. So as I've gotten more and more into toward the sailing community, I've been totally impressed or blown away by how helpful people are in that community. Whether you're coming into dock and you need someone to catch some lines, or whether you're working on your boat and somebody's walking by on the dock and they say, hey, you need a hand, or do you need any parts or something like that. It's just remarkable how sort of helpful and supportive I have found, particularly the cruising community, to be. And I've often said to Mike, you know, if we could take that and bottle it and put it out into the rest of society, the world would be a much better place. So from your perspective as a psychologist, what's sort of going on here? What causes that? And you know, how can it be replicated? I mean, I think about it even from a business organization perspective, it would be wonderful, right, to have that type of interaction between individuals.
I would agree with you. I think part of that is sailing is definitely, it is a community without question. There's a selection bias there, right? Like not everyone sails and not everyone, it's just not for everyone. So, you know, from a distance, it looks great. Like almost any person you talk to about sailing and, you know, they see a picture of, you know, this pristine, beautiful, crisp white yacht in these, you know, azure waters and all this kind of stuff, it looks good. And they romanticize it in their mind and they think, that's really cool. You know, it must be really neat. But the reality of it is quite different. I mean, the reality of sailing, it's a tremendous amount of work. It's a pretty steep learning curve. I mean, you can teach somebody to sail very quickly, but it takes a long time to teach them to sail well. And, you know, we talked earlier about all the planning and things that get in, and there's a lot of mundane stuff and work that have to be done to realize that romanticized element. And, you know, so as a result, it's a lot more challenging than I think it looks. So that filters a lot of people out. So what you get are people that are really dedicated to it, that you know, to some degree define themselves through it. I mean, most people that are sailors or yachtsmen or yachtspersons or whatever we're calling ourselves these days, you know, there's they've been through some things to get there. They've kind of earned their stripes a little bit, and they're a little bit protective of that, and it becomes kind of an insular community. But once, you know, once you're one of them, then, you know, we have that shared basis. We've all been through it, we all understand it, we all love it, we all have a passion for it. And that's the thing, that romanticized element that people think about, when you get there, it's actually there. It's way better than what you imagined. You know, you have those sublime moments sailing and cruising that are unlike anything you'll ever experience, whether that be the crew coming together, you know, people that you'll have formed lifelong relationships, or things as simple as, one night I was doing a race and I was down below and a bunch of commotion up on deck. And Chris, you gotta get up. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what broke? You know, do we have a man overboard? You know, what happened? They're like, you gotta see this. And I come up and it was one of those nights where you could see the Milky Way, like the stars were clear, there was no light pollution. And at that moment we were sailing through a school of phosphorescent jellyfish. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I'll never forget it. Like I get chills even just talking about it. So, you know, the work that goes into it is very, very much rewarded. And as a result of that, you know, we share that element of having that idealized version of what sailing is, why we're passionate about it, why we do it, why we got into it. And that in and of itself is the foundation of a sense of community. Add to that the fact that, you know, sailing is slow. There's, you know, most people who are good sailors understand delayed gratification. They understand sitting on shore waiting for a weather window, you know, and that can be the greatest thing ever, where you're hanging out, having rum drinks, waiting for the weather to clear with, you know, getting to know new people, or it can be the most intensely frustrating thing. If you've got a deadline and you got to get a boat somewhere, you know, if you're doing a delivery or if you have to get your boat somewhere, that's intensely frustrating. But it's, you know, something that not everyone understands, but the people around you, they do. They know how hard it is to back a boat into, you know, a slip with a crosswind. So of course they're going to be there to jump out and catch some lines for you and help you and make your life a little bit easier, knowing that when they're coming in, somebody else will do that for them. So there's that reciprocity. And there's, I think, too, you know, a bit of a tolerance for suffering in sailing. Like there are times when it's arduous. Like the old joke is, you know, if you want to see what sailing is like, stand in front of a fan wearing wet clothes, tearing up $100 bills while someone throws buckets of water at your head, you know. And it's the same thing with racing, except they're $1,000 bills. You know, but we do it because we love it. And there's a certain element of craziness to that. And that's what drives the community, that shared norms, that shared worldview. And in the world that we all live in right now, I mean, I'm going to get all anthropological about it for a moment, but, you know, the culture wars are alive and well. You know, we're more isolated than ever, whether it's because of technology or, you know, we could, I'm sure that any of the three of us could do an hour on why the world is the way that it is. But when you have this oasis of sailing, and it's not just sailing, power boaters, you know, we give them a bad name, but they're right there with us. You know, there's something about being on the water. There's an element of history to it. You know, the call of the sea, you know, it, in literature and all these different things, it's kind of real. I mean, and there's a mutual respect that comes from that, from that shared history. And, you know, it comes to some degree, you can see it in workplace environments where people have, you know, in a startup environment where everybody's bought into the mission and we're all together and we believe in this thing that we're doing. And people outside think we're crazy. And, you know, why are you working, you know, 36 hours a day on this project? Well, because I love it, because I believe in it, and it's something that I really want to do. You don't find that everywhere, but you do find that in the sailing community. And I think that's a big part that drives that. And I believe in that historical element. I would, you know, get another personal anecdote. I was sailing from the Tortugas to Key West, and I was having a conversation with the skipper at the time about, I don't know if you're familiar with the Atocha, the wreck that Mel Fisher found. There's a museum for it in Key West. And we were sailing right over the spot where the Atocha sank, and it had been recovered, and thinking through, you know, the history of that. Like, you know, hundreds of years ago, there were these guys on a wooden ship in a hurricane that died in this spot, and they were sailing, you know, and here we are sailing. Now, mind you, you know, the night before we were at anchor and the Tortugas having ice cream, you know, which is unusual on a sail, but it gives you a sense of, you know, the quality of the ride. But there's a connection to that history, you know, and it's not a small thing. And I think people who really embrace the sailing and the history, they enjoy that element of it. And I think that's part of what brings us together. I don't know if that's really a psychological analysis. It's really more, like I said earlier, an anthropological analysis. But I think that culture and that piece of it really, really draws us together. And you know, we're human beings. We like to affiliate. We like to affiliate with, you know, in groups. And, you know, you can, the culture, we're still alive and well at the Yacht Club. I mean, you can draw a line between, you know, the red and the blue. But at the end of the day, they still have a foundational reason why they're there that supersedes that. And it kind of gives you a little bit of hope, right? Because you can have that conversation across the bar with that person and not despise them for their beliefs, or not, you know, come to blows over a silly political position, because this is bigger than that. And for a lot of us, you know, maybe if we're not religious or not spiritual, maybe this is our thing that is bigger than that, that brings us together.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Or I may be overthinking it too. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I think there's some depth here that's worth kind of experimenting with and playing around with. And again, this might be a whole nother podcast episode to dive a little deeper into this. And, you know, the combination of psychology and anthropology and even a little bit of religion might be some interesting ways to unpack some of these shared suffering and shared experiences, right? Yeah. If you think about this, these are the things that have brought a lot of people together over the centuries.
Absolutely.
And there might be a few good tidbits, right?
Yeah. I mean, what better way to come together with people, you know, doing something you're passionate about that's challenging and overcoming those challenges. And, you know, there's that element of that. I guess that's the other piece I would add, is self-reliance. And I tell clients this when I'm doing the yacht brokerage thing, is especially if they're new to sailing or boating, you will learn just how self-reliant you can be. Like when you're offshore and your engine is dead and you need to do something to get yourself and your crew and people that you're responsible for, you know, there is a survival element to it. And you need to make something happen. You do it and you make it happen and you get in at the end of the day. And, you know, years later, it's this great story. But in the moment, it's, wow, you know, I was able to do this and I was able to rely upon myself and the tools and equipment that I have available to me, my knowledge and experience. and make something happen. And that confidence, you know, there's your link back to the workplace is yeah, I can manage a crisis when it comes. I'm not going to panic. I'm not going to freak out. You know, we've been through different crises before. We'll get through them again. This is another example of that. And you learn problem solving, you know, in a sort of mechanical, nautical environment. And those things translate into the organizational world in which we spend most of our, you know, working hours.
Yeah, you know, I like it. As you were saying that, it got me thinking a little bit, Chris. So some of our listeners know I've been a member of the National Ski Patrol for 50 plus years. And I've often, here's another organization that sort of has a common goal, right? It has a lot of parallels to sort of the boating community. And what's always struck me is that in this National Ski Patrol organization, there are people who are multimillionaires who are part of it, and there are other people who are living in their car in the parking lot at the ski area that are part of it. So yep. There's this huge diversity of economic and socioeconomic sort of people involved in it. But when you're in the organization, there's no class at all. People that totally vanishes.
Yes.
Nobody sees that. And I see to some extent the same thing, you know, sort of at the marina. There are people, you know, a young couple living on their boat, and the only assets they have is the boat they bought for $10,000 and are redoing it. And then next to them is the person that's got the $1 million yacht. But they help each other.
Yep. Yeah.
And
there's an equal footing there, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of a sudden you're sort of the same, right? The whole class structure and the things that often divide us all of a sudden melt away.
Yeah.
And my observations from the other side of the pond are the class differences are a little more compressed over here. The rich aren't quite as rich and the poor aren't quite as poor, I think, as they are in the U.S.
I think that's a fair observation.
And people treat maybe, you know, white collar people, what we call white collar in the U.S., would treat blue collar people with much more respect than they do in the U.S. And that's just a cultural phenomenon, right, based on what's kind of valued. And so maybe this is the key. And again, I think we should probably park this for another podcast. I'm looking at the time. But maybe it's this idea that everybody should be involved in, or it's recommended that everybody's involved in some activity. It doesn't need to be sailing, but where people from different groups get together, share some kind of common goals and common challenges. And maybe that's one way to kind of bridge this gap, because where the three of us aren't going to change the economic reality of what the U.S. looks like right now in terms of the kind of, you know, distribution of wealth. But maybe what we can do is make some really cool suggestions for people to do. Here's 10 things you can get your kids into, right? Sailing being one of those 10, right? That can help people kind of create these shared worlds where the politics doesn't matter so much and the culture doesn't matter so much and class and race and religion don't matter so much, that we're sharing this overcoming of human challenges and sharing the best elements of human life. And maybe that's a path forward. Might be too cheesy, but might be worth trying to bring some attention to something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One of those little thin books, you know, like Fish, you know, we can write. I love it. All right. But before we wrap it up, Bela, let me turn to you on this, because, you know, you've had a long career, as longtime listeners know, in large companies and startups, educational institutions. You've seen the business world from lots of different angles. How do you see the connections that Chris drew between the psychology of sailing and organizational kind of life and performance?
Yeah, I think there's several that come to my mind. I think one is sort of the notion of kind of planning and preparation and how important that is, and not being married just to plan A, but sort of having a plan A and having a plan B and a plan C, and the flexibility as the time evolves or as time goes on, that you need to change that plan. I think that's really, really key. One of my early bosses in life once told me, and I still remember this, and he said, "It's amazing how lucky you are when you're well prepared." And,
love it.
And I think, right? It's just a great statement. It says a lot. And so I think number one, part of it is being well prepared. I think the other piece, and Chris talked about this a fair amount, is sort of goals for the team. I think this is really important, that there's a common sort of direction you're headed in, and sort of understanding sort of what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. What is taking you towards the common goal and what's taking you in the opposite direction? And I think that's sort of another element that's sort of important in sort of leadership and in organizations, whether you're sailing or whether you're at work. I still think about this notion of figuring out how to work together. And that's where, you know, practicing, I've played a lot of sports in my life, and the National Ski Patrol, we practice a lot. And as Mike, you brought up, there's a lot of professions where they practice a lot. And there's a lot of professions where it's almost like an apprenticeship model. So, you know, your apprenticeship is in essence practicing the things that you do, whether you're a fireman or a policeman or a ski patroller or a sailboat racer. There's this notion of practicing. And I think we need to think about how we can bring some of those elements. Maybe we don't call it practicing, maybe it's something different, mm-hmm. but there's value there in sort of getting the group together to do certain things in a certain way. And how do you bring that into an organization? So those were three things that struck me. Well, how about you, Mike?
Yeah, I think those three were great, Bela. And I think maybe some of the other things, Chris, that you brought out that I really liked was this idea of preparing for a crisis. Every business that I've ever been involved with has had crises, right? At multiple, yeah? Some big, some large, right? But everything I've been involved in. And I love the idea that sailing trains people, from what you two guys tell me, right? you really need to be good at reading the crew and reading the boat, Chris, that you talked about this, and kind of interacting appropriately based on the situation. So as a crisis is unfolding, A, you're trying to get an early jump on it, I think, on a boat, and B, when it does happen, because of the practice, you've kind of got some ways to handle it that everybody knows what to expect, and there's this kind of quiet confidence you can get through whatever hits you. So I thought that was a really cool kind of transfer from sailing to the workplace. The second was the idea you talked about awareness, Chris, and knowing your situation. I think you said when to sit on the gas and or when to lean on the gas and when to sit mm-hmm. back. I think this is really important in dealing with coworkers, with people you supervise, you know, in my case with students. This is all, I think, really good stuff. The idea of when you need to take charge and make a decision versus when you want to be collective and get feedback and get input and you have enough time to make those decisions. That's all awareness. And I like the idea of being aware of what's inside the safety lines versus like other boats versus weather. And this idea that, you know, what's going on in my office, in my team, in my hallway right now versus my, you know, my business unit or my division, organization as a whole, industry, right? Macroeconomic factors. This idea of being able to read these different layers and how they interact. To me, it's a really important part of being a good manager, right? It's also, I think, the same as being a good skipper on a boat. And then I think the last thing, is this, you know, you're talking about in the last part when you're saying, hey, if you can foster a shared sense of gratitude, a shared need for patience, a shared understanding of the lack of control over the environment that we all have, no matter how much power or money or smarts we have, there's so much out there that can go wrong. If we can build that into our culture, right, that the sailing community has done, my organization is going to have a healthier culture, I think. Yeah. I don't know exactly how to do that, but I love these concepts as ways to build kind of resilient organizations where people get along and really aim to both be effective when there's a common goal, but also respond in a crisis. Because that's really what we talk about in a lot of ways, right? Hey, keep the ship going steady, right? Let's make our sales numbers, right? Let's keep our profit margins intact. Let's keep our existing customers happy, but we better be able to respond when there's a big disruption, right? When there's a natural disaster, when a new competitor introduces some sort of product that we didn't know about, that customer needs change in a hurry, so that we can do both. And I like the idea of sailing. Like, yeah, I steer the ship and I make sure we're going in the right direction. 99% of the time, it's pretty routine, but that 1% or 2% or whatever where something unexpected happens, we can respond together and keep everybody safe and get back on course, right, as quickly as we can. That to me was what you said, Chris, really reflected to me as these carryovers from the sailing world into the kind of the psychology of the workplace that I thought was amazing. So that's my two cents. Just reflecting back, summarizing, nothing new there.
Think it's time to wrap this one up, Mike.
Totally. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed the other one as well. And I think we've got some topics. If you guys ever want to have me back, I would love to do it again.
Great from my Excellent. Side.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll think of a reason.
Nice. So listeners, we hope you also found the conversation interesting and thought-provoking. And I'm sure either way, you'll let us know. You know how to contact us. It's sailingtheeast, that's all one word, @gmail.com. And get in touch with us if you have questions or comments or thoughts. Bela, over to you, and let's wrap this one up, huh?
Yeah, so finally, listeners, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, hit that follow button on your favorite podcasting app. And if you really liked it, write a review. That helps other people find our podcast as well. And if you know of someone that would be a good guest for the show, let us know and we'll reach out to them and invite them onto the show. So until next time, signing off from upstate New York. See you all soon.
Sounds good, Bela. And Chris, thanks again for joining us. We'll have your contact info if people want to contact you on the show notes, which will be great. And yeah, sounds like we have some more stuff to talk about, so we can maybe schedule some more time, huh?
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
Great. Well, from over here in Munster, Germany, we'll see everybody next time.